church people together in one place, and then I suppose they split up the fee. And I was speaking in North Toronto, and somebody in the audience was heckling me. And she was saying, well, if all these things that you're saying about reserves are true, why is it when you go onto a reserve, you know it's a reserve right away because of the old cars and snowmobiles and all these things? So I let her finish. And I said, true, every word you're saying is true. But did you know that we lived here 30,000 years before you came? And in 30,000 years, we did not pollute the earth, the air, and the water like you did in 300.
I'm sure she was very quiet.
She sure was. That put an end to that. But you learn these things when you're a speaker, when you have to go out like that and talk.
Did you ever feel afraid, though? I mean, were you ever frightened when you first started
going
out to speak?
Oh, yes. When I first... The first time I ever had to speak out was here in London. And there was a leadership course here for Native people. And at the last minute, they had a dropout, and so they asked me to fill in, and I came here. And when I had to get up and speak, I was glad there was a podium there because I hung on to it. I was so scared. But now I'm not scared anymore.
You never know. Can I ask you, because I lost on this tape, the last part of what you wrote for the people at the prison, would you mind doing that again for me?
No.
Starting again?
Once more I stand, my hand outstretched, ready to wrench open the portals of my past. Why do I hesitate? Am I brave enough? Or will the flush of shame spread over my face and down my neck until my whole being is sufficed with mortification? What is left of my glorious past? No longer do I stand strong and tall with the glory of freedom shining upon my breast. No, I refuse to look. I turn away. Have I used up my allotted time? Shall I beg for a reprieve? Hark, I hear the tread of footsteps among the softly falling leaves. My whole being tingles. I listen for the chant. Will the Great Spirit guide my hand to write the story that's never been written? The good things about my people, their native values, their medicinal remedies, their native foods, their great desire to hang on to what is left of their Mother Earth, to nourish her, to keep her pure, and in so doing, nourish their own pride, dignity, and self-image, knowing that happiness means not being afraid to be an Indian. And another time I was asked to come to Toronto. Well, I come down to cook a meal, an Indian meal, and then they asked me to do a reading at the same time. And so I finally consented to come down. And so I got up early one morning and I went down the beach. I only lived about 75 yards from Georgian Bay. And I walked down to the beach and I sat on the stones. And the sun hadn't come up yet, but it was daylight. And I started to write. Dawn is breaking on a clear, still bay. Rose haze in the eastern sky heralds the approach of another day. Look about you in the clear blue sky. Birds all around are flying high. Seagulls settling on the water clear, waiting for anything floating near. Excuse me. Turn to the south, what do you see? Great gray bluffs upon whose crest grows a stately pine where eagles nest, hawks and crows and all the rest. Turn to the west and silently feel. Turn to the west and... Just give me a second. Yeah. Turn to the west and silently feel the breath of the west wind caressing your brow. Today he is bent gentle, but beware. He can howl and scream and rip and tear. Slowly walk to the water's edge. Raise your arms and again feel free of cement and concrete, brick and stone, all the things that make a prison to hold sorrow and tears, stories told that a weary heart must now unfold. What's in the north? Must we tell how our mother earth cowers there, where wheels and shovels have torn her breast, spilling out her treasure chest, so that man may once again his havoc work on sky and water and the earth. Alas, but yes, even the heavens tremble, where he placed the stars, the jewels he set to guide a traveler on a quest. Turn back to the east and raise your face to your creator and ask him, please stop mankind while there's still a chance that we may survive this horrible holocaust. And that's the one I wrote for that one. I wrote one too for my Native women when I was chosen Native Woman of the Year. But it's a big, long, long one.
Is there any part of any of your writing that you think, as I listen to you, I imagine a lot of it used in the slide tape show as a way of expressing how important the Indian heritage is, but is there anything specific to women that you feel is really
Well, this
really
one that
important?
I wrote for was for my women.
Do you feel that women have any more of a role in preserving Indian culture than men, or a
Well, they do.
Role?
They have a special role in the preserving of the legends, because we didn't have a written language, and the legends were used to teach our children. Most Indian legends have a moral to the story.
Mm-hmm. And was it the women who
told them?
Told the legends?
Oh, yes. Because the men were usually hunting and fishing and were away from home. And so the children were left mostly with the mothers.
Mm-hmm. Now, do you think that's true of the other crafts and skills that are learned too, many of them, that it's the women who...
Oh, yes. You know, the women that tanned the hides. It was the women that did that. The men just brought the buffalo and dropped it there, and the women had to look after it, skin it, stretch it.
It's not from today, is it?
No. But that's the way it was. The woman's, there's a book called Ishi, The Last Wild Indian of North America. And when I was very ill in the hospital with Hodgkin's disease, somebody brought me that book to read. And it's a great book to read. I learned a lot from that book. Yes. Because Ishi was a Yahai Indian down in California. And when the settlers came and they had hired men to get rid of the Indians so they could take the land, he took his mother and his sister, and there were only 18 of them, I think, that went into the escarpment and hid. And finally they all died. Except there was only left Ishi, his mother, and the girl that he called his sister, but they think it was only a cousin, and an old man. And they lived underground. And they were going to put a dam in this river, and they walked into that camp. And Ishi picked up his mother in his arms and ran with her one way, and he told the girl to take the old man and go the other way. But he never saw them again. And he thinks that they drowned in the river trying to cross the river. But he walked around with his mother in his arms until she died. And then he was alone. And finally he was starving and he had nothing to wear, just tatters. And he wandered into the corral, and the dogs got after him there. He went to sleep in this corral, and the dogs went after him. And the farmer came out to see what the dogs were after, and they found this Indian. And they didn't know what to do with him, so they put him in jail. And then in the museum in California, a man read about it. So he asked to have him, and he became a living museum piece in that museum. And he learned to speak a little bit of English, and he was so proud, he would not accept charity. And so they paid him to be a caretaker, to sweep floors and that. And they paid him in coin because that's the only thing he could count. And when he finally died, he had money in the bank. It's a very sad story. It was a very sad story.
It must have been a horrible life for him working in that museum.
Yes, well, he was a very proud person. And they did a death mask of him. Mm. And it's in that book, and he was quite a handsome man. So I've read an awful lot, and I've done I researched one time in the Rare Books Division of University of Toronto, from Christmas till Easter time, 4 hours a day, while I was running a boarding house for Native students. And sometimes I'd come out of there in the afternoon to go home, make dinner, and I'd wonder why I was living in this generation. I would be so deep into what I was reading. So I have knowledge of a lot of things. I went there specifically to study food mythology. But they got to know me, they got to know me at the museum. And so after I'd leave, I guess in the afternoon, they'd get the books about Indians that was there, like the Jesuit relations and all these other things. And they'd be there for me to go through the next day.
Wonderful.
It was. And you have to have an appointment to get in there.
Yes.
And my friend that wrote I Am Nokomis too, she got me that appointment in there for me to go in. So when I look back, I've had a lot of help from a lot of people have helped me in various ways. And I also have helped a lot of people. I know when I had the boarding house, I learned that if I felt that my students was not getting a fair deal from Toronto in the regional office, I'd go right over their heads to Ottawa. And they got so... maybe they didn't like me, but they respected me. Mm-hmm. I also learned that there was one club I could use if I felt that they were not getting a fair deal, and that was the press. All I had to say, well, if you think that's not right, I said, I'm going to give it to the press and let the Canadian people decide whether it's discrimination or the other. And right away I'd get what I wanted for them children.
People on your reserve, what do they think of all the work that you've done? I know that one of the comments on the book jacket of I Am Anokomis was that in some ways the people on your reserve were surprised.
Yes.
When you became Indian Woman of the Year. What did that come from?
Why were they surprised? Well, I was surprised too. I never expected that. I think what I did was meet the problems of life head on and make the best of it. Mm-hmm. And I got that from my teacher. I only had one teacher all my life, and she taught me all grades. She also taught me that it didn't matter what you had to do. If you did it to the best of your ability, you had self-satisfaction. So I grew up with a very good, strong sense of inner strength. Mm-hmm. And another thing was that I remember I was the third eldest of 14 children. And so I always had to do the upstairs work. And of course, we didn't have hydro or anything like that in those days, so I used a broom and a dustpan. And maybe I was a lazy little girl. Because I used to pull I'd sweep all the dirt under the bed, and then I'd pull this down and cover it up. And one morning, I didn't know my mother was standing at the top of the stairs until she spoke, and she said, Vern, she says, the dirtiest dirt is not always the dirt that shows. And that really stuck in my mind. And so some people call me a workaholic because I can't clean anything up, a room, without moving everything.
Mm. Oh.
But when I grew up, you can use that in a lot of senses. sometimes it's the dirtiest dirt. It's not always the dirt that shows.
That's right. That's right. When you were growing up, who ran the schools? Was it the provincial school or was it?
It was the federal.
Federal school.
Yeah, federal school.
And you were able to still live at home? You weren't sent away
no.
at any time?
No, I never left home.
Yeah.
I grew up at home, mostly with my great-grandmother because she was old. And so I was with her a lot.
Mm-hmm.
I went with her to gather birch bark. I went with her to gather pennyroyal and royal balm and curly sumac and all the things we used in the winter for medicine.
Mm-hmm.
So I had an early start. And I can remember when we'd gather the birch bark, it would be the first hot days in June when the birch bark peels. And we'd go across the little harbor to the birch grove. And the first thing that my great uncle did when we got there was put up a tripod and start a big fire.
Mm-hmm.
And then we'd go up in the bush. And it was my job to wipe the sap from the birch bark as it came down. Because if you didn't, the next spring when you made syrup, it was very dark. You had to wipe off that sap.
Mm-hmm.
And then we'd roll it into bundles and carry it down at lunchtime. Sometimes it was maybe 1, 2 o'clock,
mm-hmm.
we'd come down. And by that time, that fire had all burnt down. And then we'd have our lunch there. And my grandmother would take a nice piece of birch bark. And we usually had beans, what she called the soup makers. And she'd go around and gather the leaves and the little shoots up from the raspberry bushes. And she'd put it on that birch bark. And then she'd dump the beans there. And then she'd seal it over. She'd dig away the coals and make a nice spot, and then she'd put that birch bark in there and put some more ashes and cover it with coals, and that's the way it was heated for us to eat. Now I know that she knew exactly what she was doing, because there's enough nutrition in those raspberry bushes and leaves that if you were lost in the bush, you could survive.
Yes.
So you see, they knew what they were doing, although in our terms, they couldn't tell us why it was good for us.
It was just that it was tradition passed on
yeah.
and on and on. Yes. There's a book that I read that, I don't know if you've heard of it, The Clan of the Cave Bear. It's a series about a woman who lived in the Ice Age, and it was way back. And I know that what this woman who wrote the books did, she's from Oregon in the United States, did was to study with the native people in the area, and she learned what plants were important with them,
mm-hmm.
and again, it was, you know, that same sense of
like a trial and error.
That's right, and that they couldn't necessarily, just like you said, couldn't necessarily say what it was in that plant but they knew it worked.
Yes.
You know, why it worked, they didn't know,
yes.
they knew it worked.
Well, this is why I did the research I did and why I wrote it all down, and this is what I'm presenting now to the people.
The women's group that I belong to, 2 summers ago now, sent me to Kenya in Africa to go to the United Nations Women's Conference for the end of the women's decade. And we got to tour around and see a lot of the things that some of the women's projects in Kenya, and also what they were doing at the university. And the university, before things were lost, went to the medicine people of the tribal groups there, and they asked them to show them which plants and what they used them for. And then they took whole plants back to the greenhouses at the university to then test them out, to do an analysis and to see what it was in that plant that made it work.
Mm-hmm.
And they say that what they will learn there will have a bigger impact on medicine in all of the world than all
mm-hmm.
the research that they're doing here in North America, because
mm-hmm.
they're holding on to
the
things that we've known for a long time.
The things that nature gave to
That's
us.
That's right. That's
and, you
right.
know, Native people have a belief that when we were created and put here, that our Creator left everything here for us that was necessary for a strong, healthy body and mind. All we have to do is find it and persevere. This is what I was taught. It's there if we just can find it.
Yeah.
He didn't put us here just to die, but to be able to use the things he left for us. And in Toronto, there's a big herb store just east of Broadview. It's on the north side. And he brings in people to teach herbs so he can sell those herbs that he's got in the store. And he tried to get me to come down and teach native herbal medicines. And I needed the money very badly. But because of my background and the things I was taught and what I believe in, I couldn't. Because I was taught that you never sell medicine what you take from Mother Earth. You take what you need, and what you don't need, you leave it for somebody else. And finally I told him why I couldn't. He offered me $30 an hour to come and do that. He said, there's lots of people that phone in and want a native herbalist. But I finally turned him down. I said, I can't. He said, I'll pay your way down. I'll pay for a place for you to stay, and I'll pay your way back. But I couldn't. My conscience didn't let me.
That's interesting. I've heard other people say the same thing.
That it's not to be sold.
Yes. If you... could tell everybody what to do to preserve all of this native culture, what would you like to see done, both on the reserves and in the cities, to help hold on to the culture?
Well, I think one of the things that I'd like to see happen was the end of pollution, because this is really what's going to kill us, is pollution. That's number one, I think. Because Indian people did not pollute and were very, very conscious of pollution. And when the white man first came, they wouldn't accept any of the food he brought if it clouded the water when they cooked it. Everything had to be clear. So that, to me, is number one. It should be in all our lives, is to be aware of what we're doing to ourselves, to our life, to our next generations. This, to me, is very important. I don't know how other people feel, but that's one of the things that really, I lay awake some nights and think about it. Because the pollution is pretty bad. Now, this year we didn't get much maple syrup. The sap trees didn't run very good. Maybe it was because of acid rain. Because one of my granddaughters is a teacher, and last fall she wanted to get some nice red maple leaves, you know, to bring in. She said she never found one leaf that wasn't full of holes in all the things she got. And you see, the acid rain is killing our lakes, our rivers. What's going to happen when you don't have water? And you know, all the time I lived at Cape Croker, we always had good water. For the last 3 years, our water is full of bacteria. So even, you can still see bottom when you go out, but there's bacteria in it already that's no good for us. We have to put Javex or boil it. And boiled water doesn't taste the same.
No, it doesn't.
I don't use anything with caffeine in it. I have one coffee a day, but it's decaffeinated. I drink decaffeinated tea when I drink tea at all, which isn't very often.
Mm-hmm.
I drink a lot of herb tea, but I don't drink the other. And maybe that's why I'm still strong. I had arthritis very bad a few years ago in my legs, my knees, both of them. But I can walk better now since it's 2 years since I cut out caffeine.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah. And I can walk upstairs and downstairs now. So I think I'm starting to reap